My series that I'm doing is more specifically focusing on the populations, the people who use healthcare, and really, except if you remove sort of the, unfortunately, the white male, they're sort of the benchmark that everything's compared to. We're looking at lots of populations all around the spectrum. So everything from demographically divided, like women, children, and families, which is tonight, to then different categories, more like social categories tomorrow, which is going to be the homeless, migrant farm workers, HIV and AIDS, mental health and substance abuse, so some of their specific issues and how the public health system really needs to get involved as well as the healthcare system in serving these people. Hi. We have a few chairs if you want to rescatter them. Those, boy, that's such an uncomfortable chair. Please take one. No, no, you're sitting on. Is that okay? Okay.
I'll set up there in case you change your mind.
All right, great. So anyway, the first half I'm going to focus on women's access to healthcare, specifically in how the financial barriers and insurance affect the healthcare that's received by women. And hopefully we can have a bit of a discussion. And then we'll move into children and families. There are some parallels, obviously, so you'll see some overlap. But I think that starting out with women's healthcare will be a good place to start as an introduction to the other as well. Why don't you go ahead and roll the tape? Women have an especially large stake in healthcare. You think about the fact that women have more functional disabilities, or in essence, more a need for healthcare or need for, let's just call them functional disabilities, that's pretty explicit. All throughout their life, at every age group. So therefore, women, or we, often access the healthcare system or need to access the healthcare system more often. I'm going to be specifically talking about women under 65 in this discussion because women over 65 most often are covered by Medicare. There are many exceptions, but most often are covered by Medicare, which changes the whole basis of the discussion when we talk about coverage and accessing healthcare. However, by saying that, you'll see that a lot of what we talk about really applies to all women. So if we start out with that sort of mentality, I want to just give you the brief overview in that basically our current healthcare system, insurance structure is a voluntary system, so you all understand it's a voluntary system based in employer-provided insurance or private insurance. It's augmented then by people individually buying private insurance if they can afford it, by public programs such as Medicare, Medicaid, and other public services. And then, because that's the way our system works, we have a huge chunk of people that don't really fit into either or any of those categories, and so we have a very large number of uninsured. Okay? So if you have that basis of understanding that that's the way our healthcare system works, you understand then that this patchwork of services, we don't really have a universal or comprehensive mentality to get everyone underneath some sort of insurance coverage. So this patchwork of coverage often leaves women at a disadvantage because they're most likely part-time workers. Again, I'm speaking in generalities, but often women are part-time workers. They have career or lifetime interruptions, either through having children, or they're often the caregivers to the elderly, so they have to reduce the amount of time that they're working full-time. They often take jobs that either pay less or provide fewer benefits because of the industries they're in. So inherently, in the kind of system we operate under, women are at an economic and sort of a social disadvantage to being having this kind of private health care available to them. So that's a starting point to understand that there's sort of you're against the eight ball a little bit. Women also are two times as likely, because of these reasons, to use Medicaid than men. And this is all ethnicity, so they're about two times as likely to be on Medicaid. One of the reasons is because of the program AFDC, the Aid to Families with Dependent Children. We'll talk a little bit more about that, but because of the eligibility and the qualifying for that program, women are more likely to be on Medicaid, which lessens the burden a little bit of them not having health insurance. However, it still fails, this program, despite its good intentions, still fails to meet and to reach many, many poor women. Since the national average for eligibility for Medicaid and AFDC on average is 44% of the poverty level. So the poverty level, it's always changing. I know that for a family of four right now, it's somewhere in the mid-20s. I don't know where it is, but you have to make somewhere in the mid-20s for a family of four. Well, that's 100% poverty level, okay? So Medicaid, AFDC, one of the eligibility standards is the national averages. If you're 44% of the poverty level, so that would be what, $8,800, then you are eligible for these programs. So you realize you have to be very, very poor often to qualify. So there are the near poor or the working poor who often have these part-time jobs or do this kind of work who don't qualify for any assistance and therefore don't have private insurance as well. One-third, therefore, because of this, one-third of all poor women are uninsured, so not covered by any of the government programs. We also look at ethnic minorities. For ethnic minority women, these women are less likely to have private insurance due to two interesting things. One, their family structure. Again, think of women, they're often dependent on private insurance, and because that's the way our insurance works. Family structure and ethnic minorities, unfortunately, in our country has black and Latinos more often are headed by a female. The household is headed by a female, and that person doesn't have the kind of private insurance, again, that they might if the male did. And then the second reason is that ethnic minority men, just in general, have a lesser rate of private insurance as well. So they're not even having the option, even if they do come from a double parent household, most likely those men don't have the luxury of the nice private insurance as well. So the ethnicity puts women of color also much further even behind white women. Their statistics are worse for having insurance coverage. There's sort of a paradox in this if you sort of look at women's issues, and that is our country has reinforced through Medicaid and through being dependent on the primary employed person has reinforced this gendered role of being dependent. And so we haven't created programs that don't use gender as an issue, instead just use blanket eligibility. So we're often saying, well, if you're a woman and you're dependent, or if you're a woman and you're more poor or less poor. So it often is based on gender, which doesn't really break through the stereotype of gender. And so there's a lot of debate and legislation about whether it should not be gender-based and whether men and women should have the same access to Medicaid. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. Also, just so you know where we're going with employer-based insurance, we talked a little bit about this last week, and I'm not going to put any numbers on the board, but our trend right now is, sadly to say, we are decreasing in private insurance. We were about 10 years ago somewhere around 70%, and now we're down to about 65% of our nation is covered under private insurance. That gap is being made up in both Medicaid. We have more people on the Medicaid rolls, and we have more people uninsured. So that trend going that direction is also at a greater detriment to women, because as more people lose their dependent private health care insurance, then, or as a primary employed person loses their insurance, then all of their dependents, women, children, also lose it. So it's a sort of an exponential loss in health care. Okay. A couple interesting things to look at about Medicaid. Medicaid is also under fire lately, as I'm sure a lot of you know. Medicaid is a federal program that works with the states. It's sort of a joint agreement between a state and the federal government. The federal government lays down the very basic bottom line rules, but then the state creates the program and however they feel is necessary. In our country right now, low-income women and children are three-quarters of the Medicaid beneficiaries. Okay, so 75% are women and children. But interestingly, only 27% of the spending for Medicaid goes for these people. Okay, the quarter, The other quarter are disabled, blind, disabled, and elderly. And just to, when you put this in money terms, the disabled and elderly on a yearly basis, on average, spend $7,000, whereas the women and children who are on Medicaid receive $1,000 per. So it's a much more expensive group, the aged and disabled, and they're eating a lot more of the resources, whereas Medicaid, people feel like we're reaching out to a lot of women and children, and yet by far the spending is much less. Because, therefore, women and children are viewed as the primary Medicaid recipients, often when we talk, the states get panicked, their budgets are too high. I don't know how much of you guys follow Governor Wilson in California, or if any of you are from there, but they're always talking about how can we cut Medicaid. So therefore, the first thing they see is, well, we need to cut women and children's services because they're populating the Medicaid programs. They're the biggest numbers. The way that a lot of state efforts have been going about this is that they've been trying to limit, there's a bunch of ways, limit the types and number of services offered. It's sort of like Oregon's Medicaid program, how they prioritized services that were allowed and then cut, you know, drew a line underneath the about 250 and said these will pay for it, anything below that we won't. So some states have tried to limit the number and the types of services offered. A lot of states have tightened up the eligibility. They also talked about, you know, 44% of the poverty level. Well, some of the states, let me give you the range. About in Vermont, they allow women and children on Medicaid who make $2,200 a month gross. In Missouri, that number is $577. So you can see that the states have a tremendous amount of ability to create their own programs, and because of that, people even jump state borders. It makes a big difference in what kind of access they have. Some of the other ways that states have been trying to cut Medicaid or tighten it up is they have decreased the amount of money paid to providers, both hospitals and physicians. The logical result of that is that people don't want to treat Medicaid beneficiaries. They turn down. They say, I'm sorry, my Medicaid numbers are full. I said I was only going to take 20 patients this year, and that's all I'm going to take. So they're not in a very attractive patient base. Okay. And then the final one, which is also getting a lot of attention, is that Medicaid is quickly being moved to managed care. Some statewide efforts, like Tennessee or 10Care, have pushed the entire state population to managed care very, very quickly without being sure exactly as to what the benefits were going to be or the results. And on the flip side, places like California are encouraging it, but have a lot of legislation and policy to do it at a normal pace where there it can at least be some measurement. Make sure that by moving these people to managed care, they're not going to be losing out on various services. Yeah?
Just to make sure that we're not doing healthcare jargonese. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows when Leah uses the term managed care, you know what she's talking about?
Mm-hmm. All right, well let me briefly state, managed care is... it's a big word. It kind of encompasses 1,000 things these days. But basically what it is that it's coordinated care. You join a system of providers, and you usually are limited, and you can't just go to anybody anytime you want. You're usually assigned from a panel that the managed care organization has decided are good performing physicians. You know, they're quality, they don't overuse services and whatever. So from that panel, you usually are assigned a primary care physician. You need to go to that physician for your first initial contact. And if that physician decides to send you on to a specialist or that you need certain tests, they make those things. And the whole gist of it is basically to stop an overuse or abuse of the system. Managed care can take a whole bunch of different kind of it can be an HMO. Often HMO is used as a word to talk about managed care. In fact, I'm going to probably do some of that. But HMOs are usually tightly organized physicians. Sometimes not. Sometimes they're a little bit more widespread. But it's just not the old mentality of, I've got insurance, and whenever I need health care, I'll go and my insurance will pick it up. You start to get channeled through various organizations. So that's the brief managed care 101. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of anger out there. A lot of people don't feel managed care is treating them well because they're being stopped from getting the services. They've gone too far and they've said, you know, we use too many services, and now to make money, the managed care organizations won't allow me to get the services I need. So that's the backlash against managed care. And I say that because Medicaid is very susceptible to this. They've been pushing all of these women and children, and that's important to note. Most of the Medicaid beneficiaries that have been put into managed care are not the elderly and not the disabled. Most of them are still on a regular insurance-based system when under Medicaid. But the women and children in the AFDC programs and the prenatal care and the pregnant women are often the first people who are put into these managed care systems. And there's not any real good proof yet as to whether they're being underserved or properly served by these managed care organizations to save money. Okay? Let's just talk a little bit about when people have Medicaid, women and children, or especially women, what the problems that they're having, the coverage gaps. Interesting, when we talk about women's health care needs, obviously a big one when we talk about 15 to 44 year olds, a big one is contraception. Some of the interesting, unbelievable statistics is that almost all non-surgical contraception, you know, everything outside of sterilization or abortion, is either underfunded or not funded at all. For instance, HMOs, or in essence the tightest, most coordinated type of managed care, are actually the best. They pay for the most contraceptive services and have the most counseling. However, still only 33% of HMOs pay for birth control pills, which seems just a fundamental contraceptive option. Less than 50% of HMOs, again, these being the best, provide full range of options for contraception. However, 90% of HMOs cover sterilization, and 66% cover abortion. So it's an interesting thing to see how there's this encouraged or still a reliance on our acute care mentality of our surgical leanings and in a very intensive hospital-based healthcare versus the preventive counseling and contraception, or what my sources that I was reading called reversible options. The reversible options often aren't paid for. When we talk about then preventive care, once again, there's a bias towards acute care, and that is waiting until things are too late, waiting till you have a breast lump, waiting for these various things. Again, HMOs are the best. 99% of them cover pap smears, while fee-for-service, amazingly, fee-for-service covers 70%. So when people consider themselves to have the best of healthcare being in an old-fashioned fee-for-service, I can go to whoever I want. Only 70% of those insurance companies covered a preventive service like pap smears, whereas managed care is pushing this more and more. Medicaid, by the way, deserves sort of a pat on the back because they cover 99% of pap smears and most preventive services for contraception as well. An interesting thing, when a bunch of Medicaid eligible and, I think it's all women, were interviewed. Oh, I'm sorry, it's uninsured women. When uninsured women were interviewed, 4 out of 10 of them didn't know that they had coverage or didn't know what to do, even if they were Medicaid eligible. And this was for their preventive services like pap smears, mammography, whatever. So even if these women could, there's a real patient education lapse that's going on because many of them aren't able to go out and get the services they need even if they are eligible. Okay. So finally, a couple other issues about women's issues, or women's healthcare issues, is that, or a couple specific problems, is that the availability of primary care providers for women, especially for Medicaid recipients and the poor, is very, very low. And this is due to what I mentioned before, in that there's lower fees, there are cultural barriers. A lot of times physicians are not willing to live in certain geographic areas, rural areas where women have a tendency to be more poor. it's very difficult to get physicians and primary care physicians out to these areas to provide regular care. So a lot of there's this attraction for physicians to live in the urban, wealthier areas. So Medicaid recipients find themselves sort of disadvantaged because of the lower fees, often their geography, and then, like I said, the cultural barriers that keep the provider and the recipient away from each other, both in morals, ethics, depending on how a physician might feel about teenage pregnancies, not being able to speak Spanish, there's a tremendous amount of barriers that Medicaid has not done a very good job in educating the providers to serve the Medicaid beneficiaries. Also, there's great proof that a woman who receives care on a regular basis and from the same provider has a much greater tendency to receive the appropriate screenings, to get the right preventive tests, and to have their health status improve than if that same woman were to access the healthcare system on the same basis, but with different providers every time. Most often, they're not going to take the same history. They're not going to know her particular idiosyncrasies and the things she might need. And so not only do we have to get people seen by doctors, but the goal is to get them seen by the same doctor over and over again and establish a relationship with these people as well. So I'm going to stop there on the women's issues and open it up and see if anyone has anything to discuss. I know that there are some people here who have certain education or experience in the health field.
You were giving the percentage of Medicaid money paid. I wonder how much of that goes towards keeping people in nursing homes.
A tremendous amount.
That's what I thought.
For the proportion. For the number of people who are Medicaid beneficiaries, the elderly who are in nursing homes, it's a huge jump. It's about 10% are the numbers, total number, and they use about 35% or so of the resources.
It's anywhere from 3,000 to 8,000 a month.
Oh, absolutely.
In a nursing home, you know.
Absolutely. And that's sort of the irony or the paradox that the Medicaid women, low-income women and children, are seen as the big Medicaid. You know, we need to do something about them, but they're really not spending the money. And most often when the money is spent on them, it's in, and we'll talk a little bit about this with children, the $1 spent on their health care translates to great savings in the future if you can keep a low-birth baby inside the mom and not have it come out too soon. Or you can do these things in great measure. It's like money invested for the long term versus those few people using big resource chunks in the last few months of their life, right? You're absolutely right. Any other comments? Okay, why don't we talk a little bit. You can see where children have sort of crept into, children and families have crept into this discussion a little bit. Children, it's a very interesting discussion, and I don't think a lot of people have thought that children are such a distinct population, separate from anything that our healthcare system has really devised. Last week we had a couple of women who were school nurses, and the non-healthcare things that they took care of under the guise of medical care was fascinating. And it's because our healthcare system hasn't done a very good job at looking at children as their own needy population and devising a healthcare system for them. So we have sort of three trends that are in our marketplace right now that have alienated a bit the children's healthcare needs. One of this is the growth of managed care. Basically means that this is managed care is merging and turning into these big conglomerates, big networks and integrated systems, which is built on acute care and adult care. So the more we find ourselves aligned with a managed care organization and not the old-fashioned fee-for-service where we could just go and get care where we want it, but we get channeled into certain types of care, it eliminates often the ability to access specialists or various people for their children. So the growth of managed care is dictating a lot of the way care is delivered. Two, most healthcare benefits these days are based on price competition. So the lower price, obviously you want it to be high quality, and that's what's always marketed, is over high quality and low price. But usually the lowest price managed care organization wins. They get the contract. So the more they ratchet down that price, that difference has got to come from somewhere. And that's usually the elimination of a lot of what they would consider non-essential services.
Who's driving that? Would that be the employers then that are asking for that?
Yep, it's the purchasers of the healthcare benefits.
So it's the employers groups that are forming like consortiums or something to...
Yeah.
Just in large blocks.
Yep. It's sort of classic marketplace dynamics, and that is, if you know the CalPER system, California Teachers and Retirement Benefit System, Minnesota has, and there's San Francisco has, and the Bay Area has the Bay Area Group on Health, or Pacific Area, it used to be called Group on Health. Minneapolis has a very large Buyers Coalition on Health. I can't remember all their acronyms, but... And what it is very, very large employers, or even smaller employers. It's the old-fashioned, what used to be called managed competition, which Clinton's healthcare plan first advocated. And it is, if we get the buyers to come together and create a strong force, they can determine which are the best providers of healthcare, rather than having all the clout and power sit with the healthcare providers and people just self-proclaiming, we're the best healthcare provider. Well, what's happened is that has created a lot of pressure for the healthcare providers to ratchet down their costs and the buyers to choose. Almost everyone will tell you that, like if you talk to GM or you talk to Boeing or you talk to big employers like the University of California, they'll say, well, it's important for us to keep our costs under control, so we want a low price, as low price as we can get, but we also will choose a health plan on their quality. And in theory, although many people are talking about this, every single time a survey is done, when it comes down to it, they chose the lowest priced one. Now, that may be a lowest priced one that's competing among the high quality providers. They're not choosing a low priced one that's way off here with bad results, but they're still choosing the lowest priced ones. So what's happening often is that they have to squeeze this money out, and they often are taking out what are considered non-medical or non-essential services. These are the coordinating public health services, social services, educational support groups, and they're becoming just fine-tuned sort of acute care. Now that may still be okay, but for when we talk about children specifically, children have a whole different set of needs and much more complex. The third, which could be a whole discussion in itself. The third issue that's going on in the marketplace right now, along with the managed care and the price competition, is that you're seeing a tremendous amount of not-for-profit community organizations and providers going for-profit. And the for-profit pressure to be answerable to stockholders, provide adequate margins, has also been squeezing out what they call these non-essential services. So it's making them leaner and meaner in the market, but it's taking away a lot of the services that used to be offered. So this isn't really suited well to children, and let's talk a little bit about this, open it up a little bit. But there are children have three very unique needs compared to adults. One of them is called developmental vulnerability. What do you think that means? Why is that different from us?
They're growing.
They're growing?
And if they're autistic or have special developmental problems, does that include that?
Absolutely, that's part of it, yeah.
I think, well, I wouldn't say, I think everybody needs this across the ages, across the aging experience, but I think that they're more fragile at certain points in their development, and they require more support, more coordinated or intensive support from families or community in order to make the next step.
Right.
They're much more prone to accident, you know, during the developmental years, whether it's a swimming, automobile, playground accident. And those are all the developmental vulnerabilities, I think.
Would that include the shots, preventative?
Yep, immunizations. Yeah, one way, or sort of a full definition of developmental vulnerability is many of what you're talking about. But if you think about sort of a life's trajectory, we're all kind of already on our paths, and things that happen to us, we'll modify and sort of tweak them around a little bit, but we're kind of already pretty set. Little kids can be sent off a completely different direction depending on infectious disease they may get, or various small things that in our life might not make a big difference, but for one of these small kids makes a very large difference. One of the other thing is, because we have decreased infectious diseases, and kids aren't dying these days from the same things they were 100 years ago, and because our nutrition has improved so much in this country, we have sort of this category. You hear people talk about new morbidities all the time, or new sicknesses for children. Things that never used to be under the purview of the healthcare system. Things like drug and alcohol abuse of both family members, but even teens, young children. Violence, whether it's neighborhood violence, home violence, emotional disorders. You hear a lot about that. And learning problems. All of a sudden, these are becoming concerns and issues of the healthcare system or the whole public health system that never used to be issues. And so we're developing all these different new morbidities that we want to somehow help direction kids in the right way, or start them, in essence, on the right foot, so that they're not quite as vulnerable as they grow up, okay? All of these, you can imagine, are very complex. You think about emotional problems, you think about learning problems, you think about these things. You realize how complex family issues get involved. You realize how socioeconomic gets involved, status gets involved, and then you think, how is managed care, a single organization, going to actually fix something that big, that broad, without all these different services and working organizations in the community? The other interesting thing about these different morbidities as well is that kids, if you're a kid with a heart problem, it's probably not because you've eaten a lot of fatty foods your whole life and it's a degenerative disease. Kids, however, they have congenital diseases. So the way, literally, you look at a heart disease or a problem with a child has to be completely different than the way an adult is treated with potentially the exact same classified cancer or heart problem. And because of this, we often use pediatrics or pediatric specialists, but many of these large organizations don't have these people, and children are seen by adult physicians. So they have a whole different set of issues, and I don't know if you guys want to jump in. We had a bit of a talk about this. I'll let you bring it up if you feel comfortable with that. But so you can imagine the morbidity of children is so different that unless they have physicians who have specialized in the way to go at these things, an adult asthma versus a four-year-old with asthma is a very different disease process, and they need to be treated as such, and also look at the way it's going to affect their learning, their socialization, and all of these things that often these large managed care organizations are not willing to invest in. Okay? Third, the other thing is, which is pretty obvious, is that kids are dependent. They don't really go to the healthcare provider, they don't really go to the doctor unless someone takes them there, or someone recognizes their need. It seems simplistic, but it's become a very big issue for children, both in underuse but also in overuse. For instance, maternal use, or their mom's use of healthcare, is completely correlated to how much the child uses healthcare. Okay? So if the mom is well and doesn't use healthcare, regardless of the child's health status, often that child gets less use of healthcare, and vice versa. If the mom goes to the doctor a lot, most likely the kid goes to the doctor a lot. So something as fundamental as that actually affects the way a child accesses healthcare. All right? So when we talk about the health services delivery, the delivery options for children, it's the same thing as women. It's this patchwork of private insurance, Medicaid, uninsured kids. They're very dependent on their parents or caregivers to bring them to services. But they're very reliant on this sort of multi-sector need for healthcare. And the various sectors in healthcare, or the various sectors that they can get care from, are, as we've talked about, the acute care system. But also specifically, we want to talk about population-based community health, such as immunizations, screening, things that nobody is directly responsible for, one individual child, not like going to the doctor and that doctor and child have a relationship, but instead the population or community takes it upon themselves to offer full population-based services. And third, there's also support, health-related support services, or that sector. Things like family support for nutrition, church communities, special education programs that often fall under, school nurses get involved. So all of these different sectors need to work together for kids, and yet they're often not talking to each other and coordinating themselves, and our healthcare system, unfortunately, isn't doing a whole lot to coordinate that. In the past 20 years, we'll talk a little bit about the numbers as we did with the women. In the past 20 years, the proportion of uninsured children has dramatically risen. And it's now around about 15% of our children are uninsured. Now, that's a lot compared to, I guess if you think about it in general, but if you look at some of the other numbers, 55% only of our children have private health care insurance. All right, and that's going down. Medicaid is going up, so at least that switch, that change in where you're losing private insurance, but Medicaid is making up, that means, if Medicaid's making up, it means we have a lot poorer children because they still have to meet the eligibility requirements. So unfortunately, we have more children who are living in such poverty that they're meeting the Medicaid eligible standards, and we still have about 15% of the kids who have nothing. Two-thirds of all of our uninsured children live in working poor families, so their parents or single parent have jobs, but they can't afford any health insurance. And although Medicaid lately has made some great strides in improving their numbers, the Reagan administration was the first to take some big cuts out of Medicaid. And it took about 5 or 6 years until some of those cuts were put back into place, or in essence, the cuts were removed, and we started to increase the rolls and be more generous for low-income women and children for Medicaid. So we're seeing an increase a bit in the Medicaid eligibility, but not enough to cover all the uninsured children. Okay. And then I guess the other biggest problem with Medicaid is that every year, 40% of Medicaid beneficiaries, low-income women and children, turn over. So you may be allowed to be on Medicaid this year, but 40% of the people who are on it this year won't be allowed to be on it next year. So you can imagine just that shift alone ends up removing regular source of care, removing all these relationships, if any were started, then they go uninsured and they no longer have the ability to access those people. Talk a little bit about where this is all going for the future, or where what we maybe need to do for children. There's a real push to create an integrated healthcare system. There's a thing called the Bright Futures Project, and it's the Healthcare Financing Administration and the Child Health Bureau have come together, and they've created four like catchwords to try to create a child's healthcare system that fits in with ours, or if it has to, stand alone. These four words are: we need comprehensive, continuous, coordinated, and accountable. And you realize when they say those four words, you're really talking about a very integrated, single system if you're going to get continuous, coordinated care and yet have it be accountable. Somebody knows what's happening to the children. The only way this can be done is that if we get all of our children on health insurance. There has been more receptivity to having universal coverage paid for by our government for all children, and when they reach a certain age, they either have to go to employment-based insurance or means testing welfare programs, but basically wanting to get all children covered so they have the access they need. You hear about block grants, potential for block grants. There's a lot of fear of block grants for children's health care, because if the states are allowed, they just get a chunk of money and the federal government takes away the rules about how much money has to go to school lunches, how much money has to go to these sort of non-healthcare programs. They figure that a lot of the money will sort of leak away from the nutrition and from the social support for kids, and instead go to higher visible services, and at a great loss, again, for the children more than any other population. A second thing that's going on in the future is to really remove any barriers about integration. Private organizations, managed care organizations, hold their data very, very closely. So they don't like to really share if a child or someone's going to totally leave their realm of care and go to a different organization. They don't like to turn over all the charts and turn over all the costs it took them and all of this. So often children have to start over. But the goal is to get this integrated so that children have the ability to move around or get the care they need without having this private information be bundled up with each and every one of our market-based healthcare plans. Third, there's a lot of desire for public accountability. We can talk about all the statistics in the world here, but everyone acknowledges that healthcare data is really slippery. Like, you never really know for sure what the numbers are because, again, a lot of places don't want to let their information out or how much things cost. And so if we had some sort of, most European countries have a very strong public health nursing program. They keep track of immunizations for each child or for a whole population and for screenings that are given. And so there's this very good database as to rates of disease and the way populations might have an outbreak of some sort of cancer, and they look into why that would be. In our country, it's much more haphazard, and the information doesn't it leaks out only in bits and pieces. And for our children, we have these developmental needs that the school could use and the rest that they're not getting their hands on that information. So there's a big push to get monitoring systems going as well. And then finally, sort of where we started this talk of child health care is that we need child-specific standards. And I don't know how many of you in your work see this, but that the guidelines we have and the standards we have or protocols we have that people are talking about how to deliver health care the best way is geared, once again, very much for adults, people who can take their own pills, people who can set alarm clocks and get up to do things, people who can make appointments. But most of our standards and our guidelines, both for the actual healthcare and for the way people have the regimens they have to follow, don't apply to children, just not at all. And so some organizations are, for the first time, creating very child-specific guidelines on how to best treat these kids, but not under the adult paradigm, the adult way of doing it. So having said that, I'd like to just open it up and see if anybody has any comments or share any experiences, or I know we have a few people who are working directly in public health and with programs to help both low-income women, children, and some of these populations and families.
One of the most successful models I've seen around is coming out of mental health, Medicaid mental health, it's called wraparound or integrated tailored care, mm-hmm. individualized tailored care, where the is either the case manager, therapist, or some other advocate in the community will bring together the team of community and primary care providers and sit down with the family and provide, you know, across the community, provide services, managing the care, so to speak, mm-hmm. throughout the system, and also removing the funding barriers that exist. So they would have linkage also to people that hold the money in Department of Children and Family Services or in the school district or whatever.
And that's a state Medicaid program that's doing that?
It's the state of Washington. The state here, we're still in Washington, aren't
we? Yes.
Different than has consultants that they have, and they are, we in Clark County down in Vancouver, we just had the Washington Business Group on Health come in and look at how well we're doing that and where the gaps are in services and who holds the values and who can do that the best. Mm-hmm.
When you say that's Medicaid run, is that primarily for children, or is it for even...
It's primarily, it seems like the providers that they're most comfortable using are the children's providers. They see it as, but I think it is just as applicable to adults.
Low-income women who qualify because of their pregnancy. Often pregnant women, the eligibility goes way up. You don't have to be at 44% of the poverty level, but some states even it's like 133%. The minute you have the baby, you lose your insurance, except for a couple of the first initial services. So again, it's a very volatile situation. You have access as long as you're pregnant, and then it's gone when you're not. But those are the people who would benefit greatly from a coordinated social support services.
Right, even though it's supposed to be non-pathologizing for, you know, a disease-oriented, you have to have created some problem or come to the attention of people and be labeled in the mental health system, health dependency system, in order to get those services.
Is that right?
So it's one of the drawbacks, but it's really quite fascinating to see these barriers drop away. I mean, we at one of the meetings we had, the family's pastor sitting there, along with the family therapist and one of the people from the congregation, and they were all trying to figure out. Let's see, we had the mental health therapist and a representative of the child psychiatrist and the PCP. The PCP wasn't there, but the information was coming through and being fed back.
Yeah, hopefully they'll transfer that model to a lot of different populations and not just have it be in the mental health.
Right. That would be wonderful to
right.
see
right.
that idea. So those are initiatives that are coming out of, I guess it's coming out of the National Institute of Mental Health.
Washington, D.C. based group.
Yeah.
I've got just a question, and you might have mentioned this in either one of your other sessions, but on the group that is uninsured, typically what is the result of that? Is that they are being denied services? I know you talked about that a little bit tonight. Or is it that they just are not accessing the services? Or is it that they're accessing it and the facility is picking up the cost?
So not why are they uninsured, but how do the uninsured use healthcare?
Right. Are they just not getting the preventative care? And
mostly, they're accessing in total a lot less. Okay. So first of all, they get less services. They go less often to to healthcare providers for preventive services or anything. Secondly, when an uninsured person doesn't use the healthcare system or primary care as often to catch the little things, what happens is they come into the system later when they're much sicker. They might have full-blown something, you know. So they're more expensive often. Now, depends on where they go for care. Some places provide charity care, and one of the long-standing complaints of private insurance is that they have been footing that bill. Private insurance hasn't been paying when they're billed, or when it costs the place a dollar, they're not billed a dollar. They're billed $1.20 or whatever, and that makes up for the charity care that a hospital or provider can provide. So they use healthcare less. They usually go in when they're more sick. They often spend down and become poor and therefore become eligible for one of the welfare programs when they're much sicker or when they've spent down their assets. So eventually those people might qualify for a welfare assistance, but generally they're the working poor. If you look at their demographics, they're usually 15 to 44, sometimes 15 to 64, you know, before Medicaid clicks in, and they're usually families and they're usually working. So it's you know, not necessarily the most unhealthy group, but they have a whole different set of things. Usually the working poor have worse nutrition. They often don't live in nice housing. They might be exposed to environmental hazards like kids with lead paint. All of these things that once again set them off on a trajectory that's going to be bad news down the line. So basically, I hope that answers your question. They're a very hard group to get a hold of because as people fall off the ranks of Medicaid and fall off these other programs, the uninsured group is constantly changing. Job changes affect them and the whole bit.
We might say the whole reason that the family is into the into the healthcare. Leah has a sister-in-law, I have a daughter-in-law, in other words, that is an OB nurse in Denver's University Hospital. And to validate anecdotally what Leah was alluding to, she works on the labor OB ward, and they will have I've forgotten, she gave me the numbers one time, but untold numbers of young new mothers ranging in from 14 to 19 who are present ready to deliver their child, and they've never seen a doctor in that entire time. Unbelievable to me.
And you know, the controversy in California with I can't believe I'm not going to remember the number, 209 or 187 or something. There's always all these different propositions going around that were voted on. You know, the proposition in California is to remove all health care and social services to illegal citizens or illegal aliens, I guess. But the problem is those people show up on the doorstep with zero prenatal care, often presenting, you know, tons of symptoms.
The state takes care of
it. And then exactly.
I work in OB too, and I'm in Oregon, and the incredible change since Oregon Health Plan has taken over.
That's their Medicaid program.
Right, and it's pretty incredible. Because I work in a small, unincorporated hospital. It's not attached to anybody or anything in a smaller city in Oregon. And when it was Medicaid, you know, through the U.S. government, we would have people from the community and the outlying communities who this would be the hospital where they would come to deliver, and it's where they wanted to come. But they couldn't because Medicaid, they didn't cover us. So they would do that exact thing. They'd show up in labor.
I'm supposed
to go to the medical school to deliver my baby, but I don't want to.
And I'm already in labor, so you can't, transfer me.
And couldn't transfer them.
Right.
And also people who come forth with no prenatal care. Well, right then and there, whether they've had no prenatal care or they're supposed to go somewhere else, they are high risk.
Yeah.
Because you don't know anything about them.
Right.
Nothing.
Right. And Medicaid, to give credit where credit's due, Medicaid has created a whole different set of eligibility requirements for, and much better, much more lenient, for low-income pregnant women, because they have recognized the absolute essential need for prenatal care and getting these people, and yet there still are these exact same issues, is that providers still either might not want to take them due to cultural barriers or due to just that worse payment, you know, lower reimbursement. So they've acknowledged the fact that, boy, if we could just get these moms healthy before they have their babies, we're going to save money, and yet it's still not being fully effective, right?
Well, I've seen a huge difference, and the women do have huge choices on who they can go to on the Oregon Health Plan.
Why the huge change? What's the premise of the Oregon Health Plan?
Well, first of all, you have like about 8 different plans that you can choose from. You can choose different insurance groups. Kaiser's one of them. Sisters of Providence. There's like. And so then the person who's applying for the Oregon Health Plan chooses the insurance company that they want to use that's available. And then those insurance companies obviously do have certain physicians and hospitals.
Sure, just like regular managed care.
Right, but it's just like private insurance that I have. I mean, it's the same kind of thing.
So Oregon has channeled all of their so-called
welfare
recipients into it.
Right. I don't believe they do the Medicaid thing. They don't get any Medicaid money, do they, on their own federal. I think they just do the Oregon Health Plan. I think that's part of.
Well, I think is Oregon wasn't that a block grant deal?
Yeah. Well,
it's not a waiver.
It's not a block grant, it's a waiver. Yeah. And what that basically means is that you go through this application process as a state and you say, please let me waiver, or in essence be released from some of the federal rules, because we want to try getting our Medicaid recipients into managed care or have more control over our Medicaid program, and the federal government, upon recognizing that the states and wanting the states to take the responsibility and just say, fine, we want to wash our hands of the responsibility, that many, many states have been granted waiver. So it's interesting because there's all of these little mini experiments going on. Oregon has this experiment, Minnesota has theirs, California has theirs. 10 Care was one of the first ones in Tennessee to push everybody into managed care. Now the big question is going to be, are we measuring the results? You know, are Medicaid recipients happy? Do they think they're getting better care? Or are they, you know, are they healthier? Are the babies coming in healthier?
Well, if you judge from better care from no care,
sure. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's an improvement.
And you still have people showing up with no care, you know, who are totally access. Eligible, and they, you know, it's too hard
right.
to sign up for. It is complicated, I must admit that.
In your opinion, are Medicaid recipients finding providers that are willing to take them?
I don't think the providers have a choice. If they sign up
for a primary care physician mm-hmm. through insurance.
So yeah. That's one of the things is that the fee structure changed because they're capitated, so they get paid more.
Yeah. So they're groups. Probably happy to take them.
Well, right, and they're part of also the group, so that mm-hmm. so now you have someone that's access to the whole plan mm-hmm. as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
Oregon's being watched nationwide to see how whether it works, but it's as Leah says. We got all these pilot projects that talk about an American health system non-system. We're in a crisis right
well,
now.
Well, and that's a fascinating thing because there are success stories going on, but when you really look at it in terms of, once again, a comprehensive, continuous, coordinated, accountable program, mm-hmm. the nation is going backwards.
It's really true because, see, I have a son who's on the Oregon Health Plan who is mentally ill, and I'm really anxious to hear. And he... You know, he has to stay on the Oregon Health Plan. He has to do things that are against how we believe an adult person should take care of themselves. But being a mentally ill adult person, he has to work less so he can stay
right.
on the plan. And I mean, it's like...
Well, I don't mean to end this on a dour note, but two examples of something like that. One, when an elderly person is needs nursing home care, there are stories of a couple divorcing mm-hmm. so that no longer they share each other's assets. If they divorce and one of the persons holds the house and the rest, this person then looks really, really poor, so they qualify for Medicaid. And on the flip side, we have an unfortunate sickness in John's family, and his sister and fiance can't get married. He's got leukemia and is in chemotherapy right now, and they would like to get married, but they can't get married because if they get married, he loses all of his benefits because she'll have to lose all of her assets.
Uh-huh.
So he has to remain a single man who's disabled and therefore qualifies for state care. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, he gets no chemotherapy, he gets no care, and so they would love to be married, but they can't. So there are very perverse incentives that we have not been able to sort of ethically and coordinated figure out. Everyone kind of gut knows, oh, this doesn't seem or feel right. Mm-hmm. And yet, fortunately, everyone's experimenting because there are great improvements being made. But until we sort of collectively learn from each other and go, okay, yes. let's try this across everybody and just get everybody insured and have access, we're just going to have all these little failures going on as well.
Well, that comes back to this, you're no longer strangers stuff.
Thank you.
Well, and most especially when you're personally involved with a situation like that, or like we have become with our son, it just makes it all real.
Yeah.
And
it's played out. And it's played out, we can talk about it in seminars like this, but it's played out thousands and thousands of times.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And the question is, isn't there a model out there that we can adopt that has compassion, that has, and apparently not, you know, Clinton says he's going to call together under Hillary's leadership this great conference, and it did not absolutely nothing, or practically nothing.
Well, that's not necessarily
that's another whole subject. We're going to do medical ethics. What am I doing medical ethics?
Probably after we leave.
Thursday
or Friday, one of the two.
We're doing Thursday. What are you doing tomorrow?
I'm doing very specific vulnerable populations. The homeless, Indian Health Service, mental health, I'm going to try to structure it as very much, because of all these different things, we're not going to walk through every single one of all of their needs and issues, but really try to paint a picture as to what's going on out there with our public health system and how these categories of people are completely needing to use the service for their own specific issues.
It doesn't really fall in the right sequence, but because of who's here or who we read who was here, I'm doing medical ethics on Thursday and then a theology of healthcare on Friday. And this week really would have been better if we had started out with a theology of healthcare on Monday. But
some of that you did today.
Well, a little bit of it today, so. Okay.
Thanks for coming,
yeah,
everybody.
Thanks for having me.